Well, we're here at the, let me begin to tell you where we're at today. We're at the Geophysical Institute on the University of Alaska Fairbanks campus in Hyo Eiken's office. He runs a cold lab here, and I'll let him explain that when we get to those questions. I'll start with the Hansen family, and why don't you start with question number one?
Okay, this is Felicia. What is a cold lab?
Hey, Felicia and everybody else. Hope you had a good weekend here. This is Hyo. Okay, what is a cold lab? Well, a cold lab is a lab where if you work in it for longer than 15 minutes, you start to get real cold, and after about half an hour, your fingers are so numb that you can't really do any microscope work anymore. That's sort of the short definition. And we're using, basically, a cold lab is just like an ordinary laboratory. It contains, the one we have here contains microscopes and special equipment to cut up ice cores, for instance, a bandsaw or a microtome. And you might even want to, whoever doesn't know what a microtome is, you might want to look that up in a dictionary rather than me telling you. But we use all of that to prepare our ice samples, but obviously we can't work as other geologists or geophysicists would at room temperature because the ice would melt. So we have a laboratory where the temperature is always at about minus 15 degrees Celsius, which is plus 5 degrees Fahrenheit. And we can actually change the temperature. Well, I guess I'm already going ahead here with regards to how cold it is, but basically the temperatures in the ice lab are anywhere between about minus 2 degrees Celsius or about 28 degrees Fahrenheit down to as low as minus 40 degrees. And at minus 40 degrees Celsius and Fahrenheit, temperatures are actually the same.
All right. The Albanil family, can you ask question number 8?
Yeah, how heavy is the ice core?
Well, that depends in part on how thick the ice is. If, for instance, when we were up in Barrow last week, Andy and Patrick went out to very thin ice that just formed about 2 weeks ago maybe, and that ice was about 35 centimeters, or just over a foot thick. And if you have an ice core of that length, those only weigh about, you know, at maximum 5 pounds. You can actually work out how heavy the ice core is if I were to tell you the density of ice. Do you know what the density of ice is by chance?
No.
Is ice denser or less dense than water?
Denser.
So what happens if you take something that's denser and you drop it into water? If something's denser than water, say like steel, for instance, and you drop it into the water, what happens?
It would sink.
So if you take a piece of ice, like a little ice cube, and you throw that into a glass of water, does that sink?
No.
So what would you think the density is of ice? Is it bigger or smaller than that of water?
Smaller,
exactly. It's just below that of water, and it has a water has a density of 1 gram per cubic centimeter. So if you have a cube that's a centimeter by a centimeter by a centimeter, that weighs exactly 1 gram, and if you have a cube of ice that's a centimeter by a centimeter by a centimeter, that weighs about 0.9 grams or 0.9 of a gram. So basically, an ice core, if you take an ice core, you can figure it's about 10% lighter than the same volume of water, of pure water. But sort of make a long story short, some of the longer ice cores can weigh as much as 20 pounds, and we take them in bits and pieces. We can't drill a core that's, say, 10 feet long in one bit. So we basically break it down into 3 or 5 or 6 portions, and then each one of those probably weighs about 20 pounds each.
All right.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Hansen family, can you ask question number 4?
Sure. This is Luke. Can you explain brine and brine pores?
Hey, Luke. Yeah, that's if you pores are little inclusions in any type of rock. So, for instance, if you look at your ice cubes in the freezer, now those are made out of freshwater ice, but maybe you've noticed that sometimes you actually have little bubbles in them. Have you seen that?
Yeah.
Yeah, and those bubbles are actually also pores. But the bubbles contain what? Any idea in the freshwater ice cube? You know what's in them?
No, they're pockets of air.
Air, exactly. So those would be air pores. Now, the interesting thing about sea ice is, if you compare it with lake ice really only contains these air bubbles or air pockets and nothing else. Everything else is pure ice. And if you've ever seen an ice sculpture or a nice piece of clear lake ice, you can actually look all the way through the lake ice. And we talked about that last week because that also has to do with albedo. Now, in sea ice, you have these little brine pores. And the brine pores are also small pockets, but they don't contain air. They actually contain salt solution at very high concentrations. And it's that salt solution that makes the ice salty. And if you lick it, or you know, if you were to melt the ice, melt sea ice, it actually is quite salty. And you have lots and lots of these small brine pores. And the brine itself, have you heard that term before, or?
No, not really.
It's brine is basically a salt solution, typically at very high concentration. So, for instance, I mean, have you ever pickled eggs or fish or other vegetables or something like that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, if you're pickling stuff, you're actually working with brine. I mean, you're using the brine to preserve whatever you throw in there. And if you throw an egg into brine, you know, you can keep that for a very long time. And the same kind of brine is present in sea ice at very similar concentrations. In the case of, you know, when you pickle stuff, you really add a lot of salt, and that's how you get to the high salt concentration. In the case of brine in ice, the high concentration is a result of the ice freezing. So the lower the temperature, the more water freezes out of the solution, and what you're left with is less water and the same amount of salt. So if you increase or decrease the amount of water and keep the amount of salt in the water the same, you're actually turning the salt solution saltier and saltier. So in a sense, you can actually think of the little organisms that are living in the ice as organisms living in brine, or organisms that are actually, you know, almost like living in a pickle solution. And in fact, some of the shrimp that we find in the ice are actually brine shrimp that are very similar to brine shrimp that you would find in for instance, very salty lakes or other extreme environments.
Huh. The Albanil family, can you ask question number 9?
Yes. This is Jesse. How many ice cores do you bring in a day, and are they always the same size?
Hey, sorry, is it Jesse?
Yeah.
Yeah. Jesse, that depends on how, you know, if on a Monday, for instance, like today, I don't feel all that great. So if I were to go out now, I'd probably stop after about 3 ice cores. But on a good day, you know, we can take as many as 20 even. Basically, it all depends on what we want to do with the ice cores. The first core is obviously the most important because that's the core that tells us something about the ice itself. And once we have that core, which we use to measure the temperature, for instance, or to look at the ice fine structure, then we may take more for other chemical measurements and other studies. So anything, typically we always take at least 2 or 3 cores and then at one site, and then at some sites we may take as many as 10, and then obviously you try to get as much work done in a day, so you may even, I mean, I've had days where I may have even taken as much as 50 ice cores, but that's, you know, that's the very upper limit. Now, with regards to the size, the diameter of the core is always the same, because that's basically, that's something we can't really change, because that depends on the coring device we use. So the coring device is just a cylinder, typically made up out of fiberglass, and it has these little cutters at the end, so that you cut around a cylinder of ice, and then when you pull up the coring device, you basically have the piece of ice stuck inside the core. So the diameter is always the same, and then the length obviously depends on how thick the ice is if we're drilling all the way through.
All right. Okay, Hansen family, can you ask question number 5?
All right, this is Tiana. How do plants and animals live in the ice without freezing?
Hey, is it Tiana?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a good question, and that basically sort of comes back to what we just talked about with regards to the brine. Now, if you think back, if you were to take an animal and put it in fresh water and have the fresh water freeze, once, you know, by lowering the temperature, for instance, putting it in your freezer, you know, once all the fresh water is frozen, that little animal would be frozen into the fresh water. And in fact, it turns out that while some animals actually survive that, most of them don't, because they basically get completely encased by the ice. Now, do you know what the freezing point of fresh water is?
No.
Any guesses?
Pretty high.
Zero degrees Celsius.
0 Celsius, exactly. And how much is that in Fahrenheit?
32,
exactly. So if you take fresh water and you lower the temperature to just below 0 degrees C, all the water freezes. 100%. All the water freezes. And if you had a little organism in there, that organism would be completely surrounded by ice, which is pretty bad. You know, it's basically like being, you know, in a very small room. In fact, a room that's not larger than you yourself, and getting stuck in there at very low temperature. So that's bad. Now, the interesting thing about sea ice is that because there's salt in the ice, the salt actually helps to maintain a bit of liquid, and that liquid is what we referred to earlier when we were talking about the brine. So at even at much lower temperatures, say at minus 10 degrees C or even at temperatures of minus 40 degrees C, which would be minus 40 Fahrenheit, there is still a very, very small, but nevertheless a small amount of liquid in the ice. So one of the things that we're interested in, and that's something we're currently studying jointly with a group of microbiologists that I'm collaborating with, is the question, well, what happens to these little organisms that actually get frozen into sea ice? And what we found is that most of them manage to somehow end up in the little brine pores that we talked about earlier. So these organisms are not completely encased by ice. They're not completely frozen in, but they're actually sitting in a little pocket of liquid. And, well, that liquid admittedly is quite cold. You know, it can be as cold as minus 40 degrees C. It doesn't yet freeze because of the high salinity, but it turns out that a lot of organisms are capable of surviving these low temperatures and high salinities if they are actually stuck in the water. Now, if they get stuck in the solid ice, and we sometimes see that as well, then typically those organisms don't survive. They actually die, and that's the end of it. But the other ones that are living in the brine pores, and I think Patrick may even put an image of that on the web, you know, those are sitting in very small pores, but they survive. And how they survive is something that people still don't quite understand. That's something that, in particular, the microbiologists are very interested in.
Yeah, on the website associated with this lesson, there's 3 sets of pictures. In 2 of those, there's a really beautiful picture of the brine pores in a thin section. I'll let Hayo explain thin sections. And then there's also a diatom with a bunch of blue slime around it. Can you explain a little bit about the thin section?
Okay, so what we do is, if we want to study the ice, we actually cut very, very thin slices of ice that we can put under the microscope or into other optical devices to study in more detail. Now, those slices are about the thickness. If you were to slice a really, really thin slice of salami, you know, you would probably still be thicker. You know, that slice of salami would probably be about 100 times thicker than these thin slices that we slice here. Maybe only about 10 times thicker if you have a real good thin slice of salami. So these slices are as little as a tenth of a millimeter thick. And in fact, to get those, we can't use a bandsaw. We start out by using a bandsaw and cutting a slice that's maybe a centimeter thick. But then from there on, we actually use a microtome. And I mentioned that instrument earlier. It's a microtome, T-O-M-E. And that is a special device that also people use in biology that we use to shave off more and more of the ice until eventually we end up with a very, very thin piece of ice. And those are the thin sections that we study.
Okay. The Albanil family, can you ask question number 12?
Yeah. Approximately how many animals live in the bottom of one ice core?
Okay, that's a very good question. And in fact, if I think back to last week, you know, we were out on the ice on Thursday. We were taking a core from ice that was about 3 feet thick, and at the bottom we saw this very brown layer of algae. So we could tell there was a lot of algae in there. But let's see whether you can come up with a guess. I mean, if we, you know, let's say that the bottom of the ice is about 10 square centimeters, let's say 100 square centimeters makes it easier. So you have a square of 10 by 10 centimeters, and that's 100 square centimeters, and then we take a slice of about 1 centimeter thick, so we have about 100 milliliter of liquid. Now, how many individual little plants, and these are microscopic algae, how many of those do you think we have in 100 milliliters of sea ice?
5,000?
That's already a pretty good guess. Anybody else with there with you who says higher or lower?
Higher. I feel like I'm on a game show.
Oh, yeah, exactly. We are. Okay, so who wants... So what's the highest you would think? Somebody else give a number.
20,000.
Anybody want to go higher than that?
In the millions.
Oh, in the middle. Oh, okay. Who wants to be a millionaire? I guess you do. Okay, so we got a million here. Well, let's think about this. In fact, typically in 1 milliliter of very high concentrated high concentrations of algae in a milliliter in sea ice can be as much as 10 to 20,000 cells. Now, so if you multiply that by 100, in fact, you are at about 1 million to 2 million cells at the bottom of one of these small ice cores. And, I mean, that is a lot, you know, if you think about it. And in fact, those are just algae. If you look at the bacteria, you know, bacteria, you can have numbers in the billions and billions in just a small piece of ice. Now, obviously, those are small organisms. If you think of bigger organisms, for instance, we found this little shrimp when we were pulling out the core on Thursday. Now, organisms such as those shrimp, typically, if you have high concentrations, you may actually find, you know, as many as 2 or 3. Again, in that little slab of ice, 10 centimeters by 10 centimeters in size.
Okay.
Thank you. That was a very fun question.
All right.
All right. The Hansen family, can you ask question number 22?
Okay. Do you ever find any large animals or fish frozen in the ice?
Okay, that's an interesting question because, as I just said, you know, sometimes we take a core and we find that when we pull the core up, there's some water that comes up with the core, and sometimes in that water there's little shrimp. And in fact, we've seen on occasions larger shrimp, so-called krill, that can be as much as 2 inches in size, actually frozen into the ice. And I was on an ice camp a couple of years ago where we even found little fish, little cod, Arctic cod, that was also frozen to the ice. So the question is, what do you think is the largest animal that I've seen that was frozen into the ice?
Probably the cod.
The cod, yeah, because the cod is what? How long? Do you know how large a cod can get?
No, I don't.
5 feet long.
If you have the real cod, you know, where you can go out fishing, say in the Gulf of Alaska or places, those actually get to about 5 feet. But the Arctic cod are actually pretty small. They, at the very most, they get to about, you know, maybe half a foot, and even that is huge for an Arctic cod. But you know what?
I thought that was brief.
Yeah. But you know what? That was that actually wasn't the biggest animal I've ever seen frozen to the ice. And maybe here I'll tell you this little story, because that's it actually was something quite interesting. We were working out in Siberia a couple of years ago in coastal sea ice, and the place where we were, we got dropped off by a helicopter, and then the helicopter left, and we were there with about 5 or 6 people, and we were working, and we noticed a lot of polar bear tracks around there. I mean, a lot. And, you know, you're obviously always concerned about polar bears, so we kept a good lookout, and we saw one polar bear ambling off in the distance, but a lot of polar bear tracks. So, and some of the polar bear tracks were really strange, too. You know, they were really deep, and then it looked like the polar bear was actually dragging something heavy, you know, with sort of leaving a very wide, deep groove in the surface of the snow and ice. So when we left from that place a day later, we said, okay, we got to find out about these polar bears. So we followed, with the helicopter, we followed the tracks, and we could see how there were more and more polar bear tracks, you know, converging on this one point. And in fact, you know, at some point, we could see that the entire snow surface was trampled by polar bears. It was just amazing. And as we were approaching, we could see off in the distance these dark spots, and as we were coming close with the helicopter, we see that there's a lot of polar bears, probably about 30 or so polar bears, and there's these dark spots, and we didn't want to go down low not to disturb them, so we sort of tried to peer out from the helicopter and see what this was, and it turns out that there were 3 beluga whales frozen into the ice, and the polar bears were just having a heyday. I mean, this was polar bear picnic all winter long. You know, they were eating themselves fat on these frozen beluga whales. And so you start to wonder, well, how do you think a beluga whale, and do you know what a beluga whale is?
Yes.
So they're pretty big. You know, they're like, probably about 5 to 7 meters long. You know, so we're talking like 20 feet long. How do you think that beluga whale got frozen into the ice?
It probably stayed there too long.
Yes, exactly, because in fall, you know, the ice freezes up, and when it freezes up, most of the animals leave, and in particular, the beluga whales leave, because a beluga whale, if it's under complete ice cover, it obviously has a problem, because the beluga whale has to come up and breathe, and these beluga whales presumably got trapped, and eventually the ice closed all around them, and they died. Unfortunately, but at the same time, those beluga whales then provided, you know, were just like a natural freezer for all these polar bears. So that was, the biggest animal that I've ever seen frozen to the ice was 3 beluga whales.
Wow, that's an interesting story. It must have been amazing seeing that many polar bears all in one spot.
It was scary, actually, because, you know, we were only about, maybe 5 miles or so away from this spot, you know, and knowing that, well, those were happy polar bears. They wouldn't have done anything to us anyways, because we're much skinnier than the beluga whales.
Yeah, all right. The Albanil family, can you ask question number 13?
Yes. Do you have pictures or slides of these animals?
Yes, actually, of the beluga whales, I have a really bad picture because, you know, we were high up and everybody was so excited that the the windows of the helicopter started to fog up, you know, so it's very, very bad. But actually, we have lots of pictures from these small animals and small plants, and I think Patrick actually put some of those on the website for you to have a look at.
Okay. The Hansen family, can you ask question number 6?
Sure. This is Luke. Does the ice change in any way if the temperatures go from 0 Fahrenheit to minus 40 Fahrenheit?
Okay, that's a good question, Luke. And now obviously, maybe we can just briefly think about this. So if you go from 0 to minus 40 degrees Fahrenheit, you're cooling the ice. So if we think back now, we've said that in sea ice, we have these little pockets full of salt solution or brine. Now, if you lower the temperature, if you cool the ice, what do you think is going to happen with that liquid brine?
Well, it's going to turn to ice.
Yes, that's exactly it. But it's not all going to turn into ice. Only part of it is going to turn into ice. So part of the liquid is going to freeze. And if you imagine, you know, you have a little pocket of liquid in the ice, and you freeze part of that pocket of liquid, but you don't freeze in any of the salt, what do you think is going to happen with the solution?
It's going to turn saltier.
It's going to turn saltier, exactly, and the size of the pore is going to shrink. So what happens when you cool ice, say from 0 to minus 40 degrees Fahrenheit, you're actually, all the brine pores are shrinking, the salt solution in the pores starts to become saltier and saltier, and in fact, over this temperature interval between 0 and minus 40 Fahrenheit, some of the salt is so concentrated that you actually start to see salt dropping out of solution, and you can find little salt crystals sitting in the brine. So that's basically what happens at temperatures of about minus 5 to minus 10 degrees Fahrenheit.
So over the entire winter, if you get a cold snap that's 40 below and then it warms up to 20 above, so is the sea ice, the pores in there constantly?
Exactly. They're constantly expanding and shrinking. It's intuitively simple to understand. You can easily see this too, but there are some very interesting, very complex aspects to this problem that we're still trying to understand. But you can think of this as the ice. It's almost like it's breathing. When it turns warm, the pores increase, and the ice, it's almost like it inhales, and then when it cools, the pores decrease. And brine is actually also being pushed out of these pores because, as we said earlier, the density of the ice is lower than the density of the brine. So if you turn part of the brine into ice, you're actually displacing a very small fraction, about a tenth, of the brine from that brine pore. So as a result, if you cool ice, you also eject or displace part of the brine. And if you warm ice, you're actually sucking in brine, and that's a very important process for the sea ice cover, and you can think of it almost like breathing ice on timescales of days to weeks to months.
This is Patrick again. Is there a difference in the salinity of the seawater near Barrow as opposed to San Diego, California? And when it gets colder, does it get saltier underneath there? Does the salinity go up?
Well, let's ask. I guess Luke. It was Luke's turn. What do you think is happening here? If you form more and more ice in wintertime, and that ice displaces part of the salt, do you think the salinity in the Arctic near Barrow is going to be larger in wintertime or smaller than in off San Diego?
Probably larger.
Yeah, exactly. It starts out being smaller because there's a lot of fresh water coming into the Arctic, but then there's some spots, for instance, near Barrow, there are spots where you put so much salt into the water column that you actually find water that has a much higher salinity, a much higher salt concentration than other places, say, off the coast of California.
All right. Thanks. Dalbeneil family, can you ask question number 15?
Yeah. Are these living ice inhabitants ever use for anything such as dye medicine or fertilizer?
Okay, that's a very practical question. Right now I'm not aware of real industrial applications, but I think that's a very important branch of ice research right now. A lot of people are interested in finding out how these organisms survive such low temperatures and high salinities. And there's a lot of studies going on. For instance, a colleague of mine is working with a pharmaceutical company, you know, a company that produces different types of medicine, and they're actually trying to find substances produced by these organisms that can help reduce the damage to tissue or flesh at low temperatures. And there's a lot of other applications that people are interested in. So right now, I think we're just barely starting to understand how sophisticated and how ingenious some of these organisms are in coping with these extreme conditions. And there's a lot of interest and also a significant hope that some of the substances that these organisms produce may help us in a lot of ways. One other example, for instance, would be, you know, that these organisms produce enzymes that are biochemical compounds that help them break down their food that are very effective at low temperatures. And if we can use those enzymes for practical applications, it might be possible to get very clean clothes without having to actually heat them as much. You know, so that would save lots of energy, would make it much cheaper to wash, and you could, even on a camping trip where you don't have hot water, you could really clean your fishing clothes, you know.
All right. The Hansen family, can you ask question number 7?
All right, this is Tiana. What do you do with the results of your research?
There's different things that we do with the results of our research. First of all, as scientists, you know, I'm not just working by myself. I'm collaborating with lots of people. You know, an individual scientist can't know everything him or herself, so I have to work with other people who are experts in other areas. For instance, I'm working with a microbiologist colleague of mine, Jody Deming, and Christopher Krems from the University of Seattle. We're working with other people. Some of them you've already met, for instance, Don and Tom. And I have students working with our group. So the most important thing is that we let other scientists know about the results of our research, because that can help them with their own work. And one way of doing that is, well, first of all, you analyze the data. You make sure that the data quality is good, that there are no errors or mistakes in the data. You follow up on some of these things. We try to develop first some kind of concept or understanding of what's going on, and then we want to develop some kind of quantitative model that'll help us basically see whether whatever perception we have or whatever understanding we have is actually correct, and then will also help us in making predictions or putting some numbers on some of these things that we're studying. And during all of this, We go to conferences, or we publish little articles or papers, as scientists typically say, in different scientific journals, so that other people can benefit from this. That's one way or one aspect of what we do with the results of our research. Another very important aspect is that if I publish a paper, for instance, I'm basically telling other people about my research, and the paper says specifically what I've done or what we've done, why we've done it, how we've done it, so that other people can check on my research and make sure that that's correct. You know, and sometimes you have a good idea, but the idea turns out to be bad or wrong. You know, somebody else comes along with a better idea, and then for those people, it's very important to have the full access to not just the results of the research, but also the original data. So another important component is that all the data we collect, we make available to the scientific community and also the public. I've had, for instance, engineers contact me who wanted to know something about the strength properties of Arctic sea ice in Alaska, and then, you know, I provide them with data that we've collected that can help them do their job. And at the same time, you know, for instance, if we have biologists, you know, we provide them with original data, and then obviously one particular particularly important aspect is that we want to keep data over long or collect data over longer periods of time, and to do that, we basically put all our data into a database that other people, you know, even as far away as Europe or Australia, can search and access. So this really is, for me, it's a lot of fun just asking the questions and trying to figure out, you know, how exactly some things are working in the ice, or trying to understand how the ice works. And then also, you know, it's also fun discussing this with other people reporting on it. But ultimately, what's most important is ensuring that all of this research is properly processed, analyzed, preserved, and then made available to other people who may have much better ideas and a much better understanding than I have. So that they can use whatever work I've done and build on that, and just do, you know, do better research than I may be able to do.
All right. Now, do you have articles in? I heard you have an article coming out in Discover magazine. Is that right? Or
yeah. That's a good point. I mean, obviously, another thing is that, you know, as I'm talking to you guys now. You know, I personally think my research is interesting. You know, it's a lot of fun, and I also convince myself that it's actually important, at least for some things. Now, obviously, that, you know, what is important and what isn't important is always up to individual people to decide. But I do think it's important for the public, you know, for people like you, for instance, that if you're interested, that you can find out about this. And one way of finding out about this, obviously, is by working with journalists or working with other people who are looking at different results of research. And one such collaboration or one such project is currently being featured in Discover magazine, where we had a journalist who came up with us to Barrow, and he then subsequently wrote an article about the search of life in our solar system and what we can learn from studying Arctic sea ice about that. So, and that actually that article, I mean, I shouldn't be, you know, whatever I say now is my personal opinion. I'm not advertising for Discover magazine or any other product of the Disney Corporation, but it actually, I think the person who wrote the article did a very good job, and there's also some nice pictures in there. So if you go to your local library, And you have Discover magazine there, you might want to have a look at that.
Yeah, well, I have to admit, I had heard that you had an article in Discover magazine, and I was kind of excited about it. So I made a point of asking you today, because I'm sure a lot of these students would be interested in reading something in a magazine like that. So thank you. The Albanil family, can you ask question number 16?
Which one?
Number 16.
Okay. Are pieces... Oh, I'm Willie. Are pieces of the sea ice used for anything traditionally?
Hey, Willie. That's a good question. Now, if you say traditionally, you're thinking of the people who are living with the sea ice. Would that be one traditional use?
Yeah.
Yeah, and actually, that's a good question, because you've talked to Richard Glenn and other people up in Barrow last week. And from what Richard and other Inupiat Eskimo up in Barrow have told me, and what I know from other areas as well, some of the sea ice is used specifically for drinking water. Now, the interesting thing there is that, and people say that it tastes extremely good. I've tasted some of this water, and I have to say that it's extremely good, certainly much better than the water that comes out of the tap here at the university. The interesting thing, though, is that it's actually not all that easy, if you're close to shore, finding this good drinking water, because most of the ice is actually quite salty, as we'd said earlier. It's not as salty as seawater. Some of the salt actually goes out of the ice, but even ice that only has, you know, about a fifth of the amount of salt that seawater does is still too salty to drink. So you actually have to look for this ice, and the people up there have a very good eye for this kind of thing. And then you actually have to mine it. You literally have to go out and use a saw or a pickaxe or something, break off pieces. You take them into your tent or house or whatever. You melt it, and then this very old ice that has already desalinated makes extremely good drinking water.
Huh. Interesting.
Thank you.
The Hansen family, can you ask question 23?
Okay. This is Felicia. How far below the ice is the ocean bottom?
Yeah. That's the question, you know, Felicia. If we're out on the ice, that's something we always ask ourselves too, because, you know, sometimes if you're out in the middle of the Arctic Ocean or in the Antarctic, you can stand on a piece of ice and the ocean can be several thousands of meters deep underneath you. So if you fall in there, you know, you'll have to know how to tread water, because you're not gonna be able to stand on the ocean. But then on the other hand, there's some areas, and for instance in Barrow, you know, when we go out on the ice, we basically drive across the snow and ice that's sitting on the beach, and then we drive onto the floating fast ice. So we're actually coming onto the ice in an area where the bottom of the ice is in very shallow water, such that the bottom of the ice is actually sitting on the sea floor or the bottom of the ocean, and actually freezing to the bottom of the ocean. And then as you move away from shore, you know, say for instance if you're 100 meters away from shore, then the water may already be, you know, maybe 2 meters or 3 meters deep. And then if you're in Barrow, at least, if you're about a kilometer away from shore, the water is probably already about 10 meters deep, and so on. So in the coastal oceans, it's not very far to the bottom of the ocean, but then once you're out in the drifting pack ice, the water is very deep.
All right. The Albanil family, can you ask question 17?
Yeah. What happens if oil, gas, or other contaminants are spilled on the ice?
Okay, that's also a good question, because obviously if you think about a lot of development that goes on, that's something that people are concerned about. The interesting thing, or also the dangerous thing with oil, is that if you imagine most, and there's actually been minor accidents, for instance, in Russia or even parts of Europe where oil has actually ended up in the water. Now, the problem is with the oil, first of all, if you imagine you have a pipeline or something sitting on the bottom of the sea and there's oil coming out of that pipeline, say, through a hole, what do you think is going to happen with the oil?
It's going to rise.
It's going to rise, exactly, because oil has a lower density than water, so it actually rises and it starts to float up to the surface. Now, imagine this were to happen in an area where you have an ice cover at the top of the ocean. Then as the oil rises, eventually it ends up in a layer underneath the ice. And so now the oil is sitting underneath the ice, and if you think back to what we said earlier about where most of the little plants and animals are, they're actually at the very bottom of the ice, at the very porous bottom of the ice. And that is a big concern that people have, and it's been shown that is a problem, is that the oil basically soaks the entire layer of ice that contains the organisms. Now that in itself typically is not good, but then interestingly, some of these organisms may actually help us in breaking down the oil. Because the problem is, once you have oil sitting underneath or inside the ice, and the oil actually rises through the ice later in spring as the ice warms up and as the pores get bigger, it's very difficult, if not impossible, to get rid of mechanically. So you can't just go in there and clean it off or rake it off. say, like people have done in the Exxon Valdez oil spill in Prince William Sound. So you're going to have to find other methods. And while, at least as far as I know, nobody has yet developed those methods, I think it would be very interesting to see whether some of these plants and animals can help us in breaking down the oil if such an accident were ever to occur.
All right. The Hansen family, can you ask question 24?
All right, this is Luke. Is the seafloor rocky, sandy, mountainous, or flat?
Okay, well, that's a seafloor question. I'm not a seafloor expert. Pretty much all places where I've studied sea ice, if the seafloor is not very deep and you can poke through, it's mostly mud or sand. In Barrow, you also have some areas where you have gravel sitting on the seafloor. But in the Arctic, in most places, actually, the seafloor is muddy and covered by mud or sand. And then in some areas, for instance, in the Canadian Arctic, you have rocky shores with hard rocks. Or in the interior Arctic, in some places, you have the ocean basins. And in those ocean basins, you also have ridges where you may have bare rocks at the seafloor. That's sort of all I know about that. But again, I'm not an expert, so.
Okay. Dalbanil family, can you ask question 18?
Yes. Do they use other transportation besides snowmobiles on the ice?
If we can walk, you know, we walk. I mean, typically we use the snow machine to haul our equipment, which can be quite heavy, to a location, and then from there we walk. Sometimes I've also worked off icebreakers where we go out with a ship, and then we don't have a snow machine, but the ship puts us over the side, and we walk away from the ship. Or in some cases, we also use helicopters or airplanes to get us further away from the coast. So the snow machine is really mostly used to in the coastal environment, in Barrow, for instance, where it's the most convenient form of transportation, and it's mostly used to haul stuff.
Okay.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Dalbanil family, can you ask question 25?
Yes, this is Jesse. Does ice ever form bottom up?
Ah, that's a tricky question. I mean, typically it forms from the top down, because the top of the ice is where it's coldest. You know, you have the cold air, and then the ocean is relatively warm. But there are some areas where you, for instance, have permafrost, where the seafloor is frozen, and there you may actually find that you find ice that starts to grow at the bottom of the ocean. Other places where you have ice forming from the bottom up is places where the surface of the ice floods, and you actually start to form ice on top of an existing ice flow. But typically, ice forms from the top down.
Okay. Dalbanil family, question 19.
This is Willie. Is there now or was there any radioactive fallout from Russia on the ice?
Hey, Willie, that's a good question. I mean, I should say I'm not an expert in studying radioactive or other harmful substances. I have just read a bit about it because sea ice is actually important in transporting some of these substances. And we have a lot of sea ice. Even in Alaska, you can find sea ice that actually comes over from Russia. And if you go up to the North Slope, for instance, to the beaches, you find a lot of trees on the beach, and a lot of those trees actually come over from Siberia. So we know that the ice is transporting stuff. But, and I think that's important to realize, we also know that in Russia, in the former Soviet Union, there are some places where they have sunken submarines with nuclear reactors. There's places where there is radioactive waste that was disposed, and there is concern that possibly at some point, but so far nobody has observed that yet, and actually we're pretty sure that hasn't happened yet, that some of that radioactive waste may end up in the sea ice, and then possibly could also end up in Alaska. What I should say, though, is, and again, you know, this, I'm not an expert, but I also do know that there's also radioactive waste being discharged regularly by radionuclide processing plants in Europe. So, for instance, there is a signal that you can pick up in the Arctic Ocean, a very small signal. It's not harmful, but a signal that originates from radioactive waste that's discharged in England, and then it takes about 10 years or 20 years for that to circulate through the Arctic Basin, but you can actually measure this. Again, it's not harmful, but it tells us that the Arctic is not isolated from the rest of the world, and there is concern, in particular for people who are eating a lot of seals or other subsistence-type foods, in particular the Inuit and then the Inupiat or Yupik Eskimo along the coasts, that other harmful substances actually come up to the Arctic shores.
All right.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to wrap this up here today. Thanks for all your questions. We'll be back here tomorrow talking with Hayo again, and we'll be talking about local impacts of climate change, what's going to happen in Hoonah or Anchorage or Fairbanks or Barrow, wherever you may live. So if you email me your questions again this afternoon, I can get those turned around to you and get the questions out for tomorrow. Have a good day.
Yeah, good question, guys.
Thank you.
Have a good day.